Hey everyone, it's Zach Reamer and welcome back. I'm about to sit down with today's guest to discuss our topic, human trafficking. But first, I've got an update. So it's been a while since I've made a new episode, so we're going to be calling this season 2 of our project. And with that comes a new name, The Montana Minute. As always, it's a podcast about the children and families in our state and all of the work that's going on to ensure their welfare. I'll continue to bring you stories and expertise from across our great state to raise awareness on the efforts to improve the lives of children and families in Montana. Before we begin, I just want to say we're going to be talking about human trafficking, which means we're also going to be talking about crimes like sexual assault, rape, and domestic violence. We won't be going into detail, but these are topics that come up. And fortunately, we have a great guest with a depth of experience in these areas. Kat Werner from the University of Montana is a founding member of Missoula's Human Trafficking Task Force and has been its chair since its start in 2013. Now, I'll let Kat talk more about her experience, but before we get started, I just want to say that it's really difficult to estimate numbers when it comes to human trafficking because it's illegal. That means it's hard to collect data, and there's also a really big lack of awareness on the subject. But recent estimates by the International Labor Organization have put the number at around 41 million adults and children who are in some form or another being exploited. And so with that, I'll just let Kat take it from here.
My name is Kat Werner, and I'm a clinical social worker, and I'm currently the Assistant Director of Field Education here at the School of Social Work at the University of Montana. And really my focus in social work throughout my career has been on gender-based violence and trauma, so particularly domestic and sexual violence, and then human trafficking and sexual exploitation. And I have worked in the Missoula community, mainly with the YWCA here, and was the director of the domestic and sexual violence program, and then through that work had the opportunity to really learn more about human trafficking and how it presents in our state and in our nation and around the world. So had the opportunity to do work on human trafficking issues locally, on a state level, and then also on a global level.
Wow. So you're really connected to every aspect of it. And I'm guessing they are connected, right?
Like... Yes. Yeah, they're all interconnected. I think it's, you know, so common that people think human trafficking and sexual exploitations are problems that are present in developing or third world nations, when really it's an issue that's happening right here in our backyard. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I had the opportunity years ago to really learn more about the issue, I was just really taken aback of how present it is in Montana and in the United States, and just became really passionate about, working to address it.
And that's a preview of what we'll be talking about. Okay. But maybe we should start at the basics. So what is human trafficking?
So really, when we think about human trafficking today, we consider it modern day slavery. And so when we're thinking about slavery, it really is about one person controlling another person and maybe using violence or the threat of violence to force them into doing something against their will. And then, of course, financially benefiting off of them. So, you know, paying them absolutely nothing and exploiting them economically. I mean, really, in other words, human trafficking is a form of severe exploitation of humans. So men, women, children all around the world. And it forces humans into providing services, either forced labor services or sexual services, which is commonly referred to as commercial sexual exploitation.
And when we're talking about the sexual exploitation, mm-hmm. it's different from prostitution. What is that difference?
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's a really important distinction to think about. There's a lot of debate about this. I think there's just a lot of missing and misinformation and stereotypes that are fueled by obviously how the media presents the issue of trafficking or the issue of prostitution and just how our popular culture views these issues. But I would say the easiest way to explain it is that a woman or a person who identifies as a prostitute or as a sex worker works in the sex industry out of their own free will. While on the other hand, somebody who's being trafficked is forced into sexual services against their will. And you know, when we're thinking about, I think to add to that, sexual exploitation, human trafficking, which can both be labor or sex trafficking, the defining elements are really force, fraud, or coercion. And so, you know, those are elements that are not necessarily in play when we're thinking of a voluntary situation where a person works in the sex trade. So it kind of boils down to really personal agency and choice when we're thinking about that distinction. And, you know, from a social work or an advocacy human rights standpoint, it's a lot more complex than that, because, you know, I always think about, well, you know, can somebody really voluntarily choose to work in the sex industry? And is it maybe more a question of a coerced choice? You know, we know that a lot of people who work in the sexual service industry didn't have economic opportunity or educational opportunities in the first place. So I think really it's oftentimes more an issue of kind of systemic inequalities and systemic issues that kind of coerce a person into making the choice to work in that sex industry.
Right. Okay. So when I have done my learning about this subject, I've heard those three things a lot: force, mm-hmm. fraud, and coercion. Mm-hmm. And you kind of touched on the coercion part a bit based on like economic circumstances. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you just briefly explain those? And
yeah. Yeah. So again, when we're thinking of, you know, on a federal level, on a state level, what are the legal definitions of human trafficking? The elements of force, fraud, or coercion are really important here. So, of course, when we're thinking of fraud, of force, that can be physical force, physical violence, sexual violence that is used to assert power and control over a person to get them to do something against their will. When we're thinking of fraud, it's really thinking about we're tricking somebody into doing something, right? And what's really common here, what's a common method or technique that is used by perpetrators of trafficking is making false promises or, you know, offering somebody a job that doesn't exist, for example. It's a really common method. And, you know, just really identifying somebody's weaknesses and giving them false hope for a better life, better economic circumstances. And so, you know, that is a technique that we're seeing as a pull factor in, you know, obviously international human trafficking situations, but then also here in the U.S. And then the coercion piece is really complex, because coercion, of course, can take place in the form of physical coercion, but most often it's really psychological or emotional coercion. And so, you know, what's really common is making threats against the person, making threats against family members, maybe threatening to disclose personal information about them. And that could be, you know, a person struggling with a mental health issue or substance abuse issue and threatening to disclose that and use it against them.
Yeah. And so, you know, what you said when we were talking about the difference between prostitution and human trafficking is it seems like there is no clear difference, and it's kind of hard to suss out all of the details. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, probably makes this kind of work pretty difficult.
Yeah, yeah. And I would add to that, what makes it even more challenging at times is that, you know, a lot of women and girls, just generally people who work in the sex industry and people who are forced to work in the sex industry specifically, oftentimes don't self-identify as a victim of trafficking. Mm. So, you know, for them, being coerced or forced by a third party, by a trafficker or by a pimp, you know, that person for them oftentimes takes on the role of a partner or boyfriend or father figure versus being an abusive third party or a perpetrator of a crime. And so it makes it really complicated for social service agencies or professionals, law enforcement, prosecutors included, you know, to build rapport and relationship, because there's oftentimes what we as professionals would refer to as a trauma bond. So just really a really strong relationship between a victim and their trafficker. And that's just because, you know, traffickers are really good at identifying a victim's weakness and vulnerabilities and then making them loyal and compliant and just having really strong psychological control over that person.
They're really playing off things that they are already vulnerable for.
Yeah, they're right. They're very good at initially identifying a girl's, a woman's, a boy's or a man's weakness. And that could be, again, you know, economic inequalities, homelessness, poverty, and a need maybe for affection or family, and then really playing off of that and filling a gap that is present for them. So, you know, we really commonly see perpetrators, traffickers take on the role of the provider or the role of the protector. And so, yeah, you know, it's really complicated because you're working with a population that oftentimes, you know, the surroundings, the circumstances that they ran away from and that they leave behind are oftentimes in their minds actually worse than the trafficking situations that they ended up in.
So that's a very systemic issue in that sense. Yeah. So now that we kind of get an idea on like how big of a problem this is, the kind of the scope of what it is and the definition, I mean, maybe I'll just play dumb here, but is it a problem in Montana?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I 100% want to highlight that both sex trafficking and labor trafficking are issues that we're seeing here in Montana, certainly across the United States and worldwide. And, you know, I said this earlier, but I agreed. I think it's easy to think that this is not a problem that exists in our state, when in reality, really, it has been a growing problem everywhere, not just in Montana. And I think one of the things that I always say when I do trainings or when I talk about this problem is that our eyes only see what they're trained to see. And what I mean by that is that it's really easy to miss something if we don't know what we're looking for. And you know, that really plays into just general education and awareness of the issue. And so, you know, just like with any other social problem, if we don't know indicators or red flags of child abuse or of domestic violence, if we don't have any information about them, or if we have missing or misinformation about it, well, how are we going to identify it and then, you know, help victims to receive the proper support that they need?
And that's one of my next questions, like, how do you identify it and how do you deal with it? But maybe we should dispel any of the myths around it first. Like, so what would you say are myths about human trafficking?
I would say definitely one of the most common myths that, again, is fueled by just, you know, popular culture and media and representation of this issue, especially in movies or in articles, would be that trafficking victims can only be foreign nationals and that they're not U.S. citizens. And so in my role as an advocate for victims of gender-based violence, you know, working with other professionals in the community, I have worked with adults and minors that were victims of trafficking, both foreign nationals and U.S. citizens, and, you know, girls and women right here from Missoula, Montana. And so I think it's just really important to highlight that, is this a problem that exists in India and Southeast Asia, and is it really prevalent there? Absolutely. But that, I think, just, you know, kind of minimizes at times or makes it more complicated in remembering that, you know, hey, this is also something that happens right here and is oftentimes driven by some of the same, you know, risk factors and kind of systemic issues that we're seeing in some of these other countries as well. I'm going to add just one more myth.
Yes,
I think
please.
That's really common. You know, and I've seen this on an international level, and then I also see it just in, you know, advertisements and kind of social service, maybe flyers or brochures about the issue of modern day slavery. Oftentimes, you know, we see maybe posters where young victims, girls or women, are chained to a bed, or, you know, their hands are tied up. And although, you know, certainly some of these situations of trafficking exists, it's a common myth that elements of physical restraint or physical force have to be in place for a situation to be a human trafficking situation. And just reminding people that, you know, physical force or restraint is not necessarily required. And, you know, again, thinking back to some of the survivors that I've worked with, not all victims of trafficking have restricted or monitored movement. You know, not all of them are constantly supervised by a trafficker, are not able to move around freely. A lot of them actually do. And I think what I want to highlight here, especially coming out of the domestic and sexual violence field, is that, you know, the emotional and psychological chains that are oftentimes a lot stronger than, you know, physical violence or physical force, we just can't underestimate those and the power and control that traffickers create and maintain over their victims. And so, you know, really thinking about similar dynamics than the domestic violence movement kind of applied over the last centuries, that, you know, it was really common in our society to ask, well, you know, if a woman is experiencing domestic violence, why doesn't she just leave? And so I think applying kind of those same, you know, thoughts and ideas and helping to really break some of those myths and shift paradigms, that just because somebody isn't chained to a wall doesn't mean that they feel that they have the power to just walk away and leave, right? So again, speaking to that trauma bond that oftentimes is in place between a victim and a trafficker, and just a really strong relationship, viewing a trafficker almost as a savior in some situations.
You know? Yeah. And as I'm connecting the dots in my head, I'm thinking back to force, fraud, coercion. And absolutely, force doesn't necessarily have to be the primary method of keeping somebody in a trafficked situation. You know, coercion can be very powerful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so, I mean, how do you identify someone? Then how do you know when you see someone, this is a person being trafficked and somebody who needs help?
Yeah. Well, I would say that that's kind of a two-part answer. I think on the one hand, really thinking about what are the vulnerable populations that are at heightened risk of being recruited for trafficking. And then what are some of the specific indicators and red flags that we as professionals or community members can watch out for? So I said this a couple times, but really thinking about vulnerability and weaknesses and thinking about that really the most targeted groups are also the most vulnerable groups in our society. So, you know, generally speaking, victims of trafficking are members of the most marginalized and oppressed populations in our communities. So we are talking about people who are experiencing homelessness or housing insecurity, people that have been victims of prior trauma, domestic violence, child abuse, sexual violence, people that might struggle with substance abuse issues, mental health or physical disabilities. And then, of course, also thinking of just anybody who might be undocumented in the United States and don't have legal immigration status. And so, you know, one thing that has always shocked me thinking about this issue is really that human trafficking is an industry that preys on the most vulnerable people in our society. And really no other industry does that, right? So there is some research out there that shows that over 90% of women and girls that work in the sex industry have been victims of prior traumatization, especially during childhood. Yeah. We also know that a lot of young girls and women that end up in the sex industry have in some way been involved in the child welfare system, have a history of running away from home. And so, yeah, you know, just really thinking about what are some of those pockets in our communities here in Montana, right? What are specific vulnerabilities that are present within our communities? And really important one to highlight would be, of course, to think about our tribal communities in Montana as well. And, you know, we have an almost 7% population of Native Americans here. And we know that especially Native American women and children have been historically disenfranchised. And, you know, so what are some of those specific risk factors for Native American populations as well?
And so even in the lifespan of a person, I think it seems like there are areas where people who are working in helping professions, whether they're teachers or nurses, they can identify this person is running away from home right now. They're at a heightened risk of being targeted for trafficking. So it seems like there are things that people can do.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, really thinking about who are, you know, vulnerable populations to think about in generally. So, you know, I mentioned most of them, obviously not forgetting, you know, other oppressed or marginalized group, LGBTQ, youth especially is at heightened risk as well. And then, of course, you know, predominantly low income girls or women, girls and women of color. So just to kind of wrap that up, and that's by no means inclusive, but just to have an idea of the population. And then, yeah, like you said, right, if we're professionals or community members, what are some things to be aware of or indicators to know? So kind of think of that second answer to that question would be, you know, what are some of the indicators? And I want to acknowledge that it can certainly be really challenging to identify a victim of trafficking. And, you know, it's just a crime that's oftentimes hidden amongst other crimes and can be really hard to just sort through that and be very sure about, you know, is this trafficking what I'm seeing? However, I would say that knowing the indicators and the red flags are obviously going to be helpful in identifying victims properly and making sure that they receive services. So, yeah, I think to think about, you know, some of the, I guess, broader areas that we might want to consider when we might be sitting down with a potential client, if we are a medical service provider, social service provider, or of course, just any person we might come in contact with as a community member in our personal lives, who we might just be worried that they might be at heightened risk or that they might be in a situation of trafficking. Some of the areas to consider would be housing and just like living and working conditions. You know, so some questions that you might want to ask or bring up either with the person or that you might want to ask yourself are, again, around freedom of movement. So does the person have freedom of movement, right? Are they allowed to kind of come and go as they please? Or is there frequent movement, maybe? So, you know, one of the really common things that we're seeing, especially in Montana, with a major interstate, I-90, running through our state, is that there's a lot of motel-based sexual exploitation. So we're seeing perpetrators moving one or two girls kind of from town to town and advertising them online. And so, you know, maybe you are a social service provider and once a month there's this girl that comes in, right? And so thinking about frequent movement. I think it's always interesting to learn more about their living situation. So who are they living with and where are they living, right? Are they living with a lot of different people and maybe some of them are not related to them or they don't know? And are they living in an apartment or are they staying at a motel, you know, on a long-term basis? So I think asking some of those questions is really important. Another area that is really important for us to think about is, are we potentially in contact with somebody who's showing signs of poor mental or physical health? And I think just to, not to get too visual, but we're talking about a human rights issue here that's really wrapped around complex trauma, right? So we are talking about victims that are experiencing violence on a daily basis. And so, you know, a lot of these girls and young women are forced to have sex with men on a daily basis against their will. And when we're thinking about, you know, sex without consent, that is rape. And that is oftentimes forceful or violent sex. It's oftentimes sex without protection. And so obviously thinking about the physical, but also the emotional and, you know, psychological adverse effects that those experiences have on victims cannot be minimized in any way. So, you know, I would just say that if you come across a person in your professional or personal life who might exhibit signs of untreated illness or injuries, and just generally, right, like a history of domestic or sexual violence and prior trauma, but then also just, you know, signs of complex trauma. So the immediate fight, flight, freeze responses to, of course, you know, long-term effects of traumatization, like post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression, substance use or chronic pain issues. So, you know, especially as a service provider, I would say it's something that we need to be aware of and really need to think about. You know, another thing in terms of indicators would be, what is the person's control over their own life, right? So is there personal control and agency, or is there a lack of control? So I'm always interested in, you know, does the person have control over their documents, over their money, over, again, we talked about movement. Is there maybe a person who is speaking for them, right? Yeah. Or who is kind of dominating the conversation when you're providing services? And especially if you're working with somebody who is a non-English speaker, you know, is there somebody who's interpreting for them? So that'd be something to be aware of. And one thing that, you know, is oftentimes we might not think of that is, but if you're working with a client or if you come across somebody, what are their possessions like? You know, I worked with a young woman a couple of years ago in Montana who was a victim of trafficking, and she was transported through Montana by a trafficker. And this was in the dead of winter in Montana. And as I came out to provide support and advocacy services to her, here she was, and she was wearing a short skirt and high heels and, you know, no winter clothes, no winter jacket. And all of her possessions were literally in two plastic bags and two grocery bags. And, you know, she didn't have jeans or sneakers or any comfy clothes. I mean, it was just, you know, it was very limited possessions. And so that definitely raised a red flag as well. And then, you know, lastly, I think just kind of some random pieces to consider would be, what is a person's demeanor and overall behavior, right? Are they sharing a story with you that just seems kind of rehearsed or inconsistent? Do they know where they are? You know, I mean, some victims are being transported so often and being moved so frequently that they might not even be able to tell you that they're in Montana or in Missoula. And, you know, another thing that we see are suspicious tattoos. So are girls maybe tattooed with the name of the trafficker or the pimp? Do they have brandings or something like that? So, yeah, I think just highlighting some of those pieces, and obviously not all of those indicators especially if you find an isolated indicator, a red flag, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a situation of trafficking. But I would say, you know, if you kind of started seeing some of those red flags, I would maybe start thinking about what is your approach and how might you be able to build, you know, rapport with that person who you might only have like half an hour with, right? And, you know, what information or resources might you want to pass on to them should they decide in the future that they, you know, that they want to reach out for support and services.
Empower them as much as
absolutely,
you can.
Yeah, right. You know, just empower them. Again, remember that they might not self-identify as a victim. Most likely, you know, the chances are that they won't. That if you ask them, hey, have you ever traded sex for money, that they might tell you, you know, what are you asking this for? Like, what are you doing? And so, you know, again, just I think remembering that and not underestimating that psychological control. But, you know, generally, absolutely, I think it's about empowerment and letting them know that, like, hey, I'm not here to judge you. I'm not here to arrest you. I'm here to provide support. And if you're ready for that now, great. Otherwise, you know, here are some resources and we could maybe do some safety planning moving forward and just letting you know who you can talk to should you decide whenever you're ready that you want to leave that situation.
We all kind of listen and hope to just learn, what can I do? What can be done? So what other efforts are happening locally in different cities or communities across the state to help prevent trafficking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually, you know, I'm happy to say that there's a lot happening on a multi-level, kind of multi-level response really in the state of Montana. So I would say that over the recent years, efforts have definitely become more organized on all levels and kind of trickled down to different communities as well. And has just, you know, the issue has just gained a lot more attention. So I think one exciting thing to highlight would be legislative efforts. So in 2015, the Montana legislature, with support of our attorney general, passed House Bill 89, which was a law that just generally strengthened anti-human trafficking efforts across the state. And I think there's still a lot more work to be done. You know, we can always do more when it comes to strengthening laws, especially promoting funding for services and victim support. But I think it's a really good start. And then, you know, in addition, on a state level, for several years, there has been a state task force that is organized and facilitated by the U.S. Attorney's Office. And, you know, they really mainly focus on coordination and collaboration of federal and state agencies to, yeah, respond to, you know, potential trafficking cases. And then as it trickles down, thinking on a local level. So there are different local human trafficking task forces. The first local task force actually was created and formed in Missoula, which is really exciting. This was about 5 years ago. And since then, there have been other task forces in Yellowstone County, in Bozeman, in Great Falls, and up in the Flathead. And, you know, those groups are all at different stages of kind of development and efforts. But overall, for all of those groups, the main goals are really around prevention, so just outreach and educational efforts, protection of victims, and then prosecution, of course, is a big part, right? Like, if we identify these cases, how do we properly prosecute them and hold offenders accountable? And then also building partnerships and strengthening collaboration. I think another thing just to highlight briefly would be that in addition to some of those more organized efforts, we, of course, have social service providers, nonprofit organizations, faith-based groups, or private groups that are really invested in this issue across Montana and have been doing a lot of great work to address trafficking across the state.
It's great to hear that there are groups that you can go to if you are concerned about maybe someone you're working with or just want to learn more about these issues.
Yeah, I think, you know, especially the domestic violence movement, I want to kind of give a shout out to domestic violence programs all across the state. We don't have any specific anti-human trafficking programs. There is a program in Billings called Tumbleweed that received some federal funding a couple of years ago, and they're mainly focusing on youth at risk and youth that is experiencing trafficking. But for example, we don't have any specific human trafficking shelters or human trafficking, you know, kind of trauma-focused intervention programs. So our domestic violence programs are really kind of the first responders when it comes to providing safe shelter, maybe long-term housing, counseling, and other resources that human trafficking victims need. So,
very encouraging to hear. So we already talked just a little bit about what each Montanan can do to help someone who's a victim of human trafficking, but maybe can you say anything else about that or any advice that you could give them?
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing I want to point out is that Human trafficking is not a law enforcement issue or social service issue. It's really a community issue, right? And so I think we have to get together as communities across Montana to really address this and provide the best support that we can to victims or people at risk. So just highlighting that identifying victims properly is really key to starting to address this issue on all levels, because trafficking doesn't happen in isolation. I mean, we talked about some of those systemic factors that, you know, continue to maintain these systems of exploitation. You know, obviously there's, as we're thinking about what can Montanans do to help someone who is a victim of human trafficking, or just generally what can we do to address this issue in our communities, I think one other thing I would say is, you know, now that you have more information about it, use it. Get out and help debunk some of the myths that are out there about human trafficking. And, you know, inform your colleagues or your family members and your friends that this is a problem that we have in our communities. And especially if you have children or if you work with children, take the time to talk to them about the risks of human trafficking. And especially educating them about how do traffickers recruit young, you know, young people, and especially through the use of online media or social networks. And then I always want to highlight that, you know, this is very much a demand-driven industry. And so we talk a lot about victims of trafficking, and we talk a lot about the perpetrators of this crime. Really, we also need to be talking about people who pay for sex, right? Men who are sex buyers, who play just as big of a role in this issue, because the demand feeds the supply. And so thinking about, you know, what can we do to address this? Can we reach out to our legislators on a state and national level and really demand some action from them? And yeah, I think the last thing, which is, you know, probably a simple thing that all of us can do, is just be conscientious consumers, right? Like asking questions about where our food comes from or where our clothes comes from. And, you know, knowing that this is a global issue, you know, how can we be more conscious about the way we consume? Because things we wear and things we use and things we eat, there's a good chance that they were produced, unfortunately, under slave-like conditions, right? And so if we can minimize some of our impact of consuming and buying and using, I think that's going to play, you know, a huge role in, you know, helping the almost 42 million people around the world that are living in slavery.
That's great advice, because I don't think that, at least I don't think that things I do every day, things I buy, could contribute to this problem. And just by changing that little aspect of my life or my habits in buying, you know, certain things, that I can make a difference.
So, yeah, absolutely. And so I would just say it kind of comes down to, if you see something, say something. And you can do that by obviously calling your local law enforcement agency and reporting tips or suspicious behavior and following some of these indicators that you've learned about. You can also, as I said, maybe reach out to your local domestic violence hotline and, you know, just let them know that you're concerned about a specific person you had contact with. And there is also a national human trafficking hotline that you can call. And I just have it in my phone, you know, and if I see something, I can just call it. And the number, I'm just going to go ahead and share it, is 1-888-3737-888. And, you know, that's a national number, and you can call them and you can just report a tip and get resources from them on, you know, maybe what next steps you might be able to take. So the other thing I would say is, if you have a local human trafficking task force in your community, reach out to them and see if you can volunteer your time. You know, we are always looking for interested people, including community members that are just invested in the issue and, you know, want to work, especially on creating awareness about the problem. You know, if you are in a community that has a group, definitely reach out.
There's a lot to do.
Yeah, there is a lot to
get involved with. Can you say that number one more time?
Yeah, absolutely. So the National Human Trafficking Resource Center number is 1-888-3737-888.
Okay, then the last thing that I want to say is just thank you for, first of all, like, the service that you've done and all of the work that you've put into improving the situation for, I'm sure you've improved the lives of many people.
Thanks,
and thank you for sharing all of your knowledge and expertise and giving it out to the world to use.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Kat.
Cool. You got it.
Thanks again, Kat, for all that great information. You know, Kat also asked me to point out that human trafficking is a low-risk, high-profit business, especially when you compare it to other illegal crimes. For example, compared to selling drugs, once the commodity or the drug is sold, it's gone. It gets used by the consumer and it's gone. But in trafficking, humans become the reusable commodities that can be sold over and over and over again. So to me, that really highlights the importance of addressing this crime, especially given the fact that, as Kat told me, it's the fastest growing criminal business in the world, and it's already second largest only after the illegal drug trade. You know, I also need to mention that we talked about the three elements of trafficking, and they're really important to keep in mind. But force, fraud, and coercion need not apply if the person providing the commercial sex act is a minor. It's just automatically trafficking. In fact, here's Kat again with some more information on that.
So, yeah, just to share a few statistics would be that the average age of entry for children in the United States into the sex industry, commercial sex industry, is between 12 and 14. Mm-hmm. So really young. And then, you know, a number that always stuck with me from several years ago that is still highly relevant is that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children estimates that around 2.8 million children run away each year in the United States. And they further say that for about a third of these kids, it only takes about 24 to 48 hours on the streets before they're being lured into prostitution, forced commercial services, sexual services in some way.
I hope that additional info really helps to just drive home the importance of understanding this issue as a child protection issue. Okay, so I hope you learned a lot. One thing Kat said was that now that you have more information about this, use it. That really is my hope for this project, that you're learning things you can use. I hope you can actually take the information you're hearing and use it to affect positive change. I'm obviously not asking you to go out and start Montana's first shelter for survivors of human trafficking, even though that would be pretty great. But go out there and break down the myths and stereotypes and answer questions and refer people to our podcast and any of the resources that we mentioned within. Raise awareness, volunteer your time, or all of the above. And to help you with that, we have another resource that comes along with this episode. It's a trafficking fact and resource sheet that you can find in the description of this episode on the center's website, compiled by second-year Masters of Social Work student Aaron O'Boyle. It really nicely sums up key points of what we've been talking about and should be handy to have around. All right, there's one more resource I'm going to tell you about, which is the Human Trafficking Hotline website. If you go there, you can find resources, information, and ways to get involved. Visit by going to www.humantraffickinghotline.org. That's humantraffickinghotline.org. And don't forget, you can visit the website to the Center for Children, Families, and Workforce Development in order to find all sorts of resources on child and family welfare. Just go to health.umt.edu/CCFWD. That's health.umt.edu/CCFWD. Thanks again for listening. I hope you'll all join me next time and we can keep learning together. For now, I'm going to let Kat have the last word.
You know, just empower them. Again, remember that they might not self-identify as a victim, but, you know, generally, absolutely, I think it's about empowerment and letting them know that, like, hey, I'm not here to judge you. I'm not here to arrest you. I'm here to provide support. And if you're ready for that now, great. Otherwise, you know, here are some resources and we could maybe do some safety planning moving forward and just letting you know who you can talk to should you decide whenever you're ready that you want to leave that situation.